Shalom Shakom and Vroom. Okay. We can go. So, this week's parsha is Vayeshev, or at least that's what it's supposed to be, right? First verse says as follows, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz mugurei aviv be'eretz Canaan. And I will try to translate. Vayeshev Yaakov, Yaakov settled, be'eretz mugurei aviv, in a land that his father lived. Now, there's a shift over here between the word Yashav, Yeshev, settle, versus Megurim. Megurim has as its root the letter Ger, Gar, which does have a connotation of strangeness, while the word Vayeshev has a connotation of settling, of being comforted. So right away we notice the discrepancy that when it comes to Yaakov, there is a situation of him settling down. When it comes to his father, who that was the only place he had ever lived, we find that Yitzchak perhaps had never really been settled there. Rashi apparently notices this, for Rashi comments, this is one of these Rashis that you look for it and then you think it's not there. It's later on. Rashi writes, Dover Acher, sorry, Va'od Nidrashbo, also one could explain here, Vayeshev, what does it mean, Vayeshev? Again, the word, to settle. Bikesh Yaakov Lishev Bishalva. Yaakov had desired, he wanted to, settle in tranquility or serenity. Yaakov, when it says settle, Shalva is peace, taking it easy. Kafatz Alav Rogzosha Yosef. And then Yaakov was jumped by, literally, Kafatz jumped, he was jumped by the anger of the episode of Yosef. And then Rashi comments, generally, tzaddikim, righteous people, mevakshim leshev b'shalva, they desire to settle, they desire tranquility. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, but God says to them, lo dayin letzaddikim mashamutukan lem la'olam haba. Isn't it enough what God is waiting for you in the world to come? Not only that, you want peace and tranquility in this world as well? It's very strange, Rashi. It's a very strange comment. But as I told you, Rashi's starting point over here is because of the change in language. Rashi's starting point is because of the words which are being used here. Now, let's start slowly. What exactly does this mean that Yaakov wanted to live in tranquility? I mean, Yaakov's had a hard life till this point. When he was young, we appreciate that things may have been easier. At some point, he makes either the wisest decision of his life or the biggest mistake of his life, and he takes the blessings from Esav, and then he goes running off with nothing. We've seen some of this. He meets a guy named Lavan, who is essentially the boss slash father-in-law from hell. And Yaakov was mistreated, was maltreated, was abused, taken advantage of. And now he's finally come home. And when he comes back, then he has this whole wonderful reunion with Esav, which at the end worked out, but there was a great deal of fear before that. Then he has the episode of Dinah. And finally, again, Yaakov has not had an easy time. And finally, what is Rashi telling us? But Yeshev Yaakov, Yaakov wants to settle down. But God says, no. Sorry. It's enough what you have waiting for you. Now, what does it mean he wants to settle down? Does that mean he wants to retire? He wants to take it easy? The fantasy of American Jews, move down to Florida. Is Yaakov going to spend his days playing shuffleboard and going to the track? Sounds nice. Sounds very nice. But what does this mean exactly that Yaakov wants to settle? I mean, if you think about the lives of, let's say the life of Avraham, it's a proactive life which reaches out to others, is involved with others. It's not merely sitting around on a mountaintop someplace contemplating God. but it brings other people into it as well. So over here, that Yaakov wants tranquility, it's almost impossible to take Rashi at face value. But let me make a second observation. It's not just it's hard to take it at face value, it's the comparison which is disturbing. God says to back, according to Rashi, he says back, what? You want tranquility here? It's enough what you have waiting for you in the world to come. Now, what is the world to come? The world to come is spiritual perfection. So apparently, what Rashi is really telling us, that when he's looking for tranquility or serenity, what he's really looking for is perfection on this world. And I'll go seven steps further than you just now went. You said he wants to sit around and chill with God. I put words in your mouth, but that's what you said. You want to say it differently? Go ahead. How do you want to say it? One of my teachers, Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he explained this Rashi, he said that what Yaakov really wanted at this point was that he had anticipated redemption in the Messianic age. First of all, the first advantage of that is then you'd have a good comparison with the world to come. And what Yaakov wanted is the era, the epic of serenity, of peace, not just for himself, but he wanted the whole world to be perfected. Now, you can tell me that's a lot to ask for. It's a lot to ask for, especially because here we are sitting 4,000 years later, and we know the way at least most of the movie has worked out, and we hadn't gotten there yet. So how in the world can Yaakov be so mistaken to think that that's it, we're there already? So let's go back a second and think about what does Yaakov really know? Which means, I'm going to suggest something which you can't even argue with me. Yaakov has a certain amount of information. What is the main point of his religious outlook based on? What does he know? So it's very simple what he knows. There was something which was called a covenant between God and Avraham, the Brit Bein HaBetarim. God made a covenant with Avraham, and what did he say to him would take place as a result of that covenant? God tells him that one day Abraham's descendants will be many. He tells him that one day the land of Israel will be his. But he tells him something else also, and what's that? He tells him that the day will come that his descendants will be enslaved in a land which isn't theirs. And when they go to this land, they're going to be abused. Let me read part of this. I'm reading from chapter 15, verse 13. Vayomer l'Avram, and the verse before this says, the sun set, and a deep slumber came upon Avraham, and fear and darkness fell upon him. And God said to Avraham, Yodea teda, you should surely know, ki ger. By the way, it's interesting, the word ger is used over here. You will be a stranger. Ki ger yezarecha be'eretz lo lilhem. Your children will be strangers in a land which isn't theirs. Va'avadum, and they will be enslaved. Ve'inu otam, and they will be abused. Arba ma'os shana, 400 years. Ve'gam es hagoya sher yavodu, and the nation that enslaves them, dan anochi, I will judge. Vacherechen yitzu b'ruchush gadol, and then they're going to leave with great wealth. Vatatzav olav osecha b'shalom, tikover b'seva tova, and you will reach a long life, and you will be buried after a long life. Vidor rivi'i yoshuvu hena, and the fourth generation will come back. Kilo shalem avon ma'ri had ad hena, for this inequity of the Emori won't be complete until that point. Now, this last comment is interesting, and it's complex, because part of it seems to be saying that even though Abraham's descendants will get the land of Israel, not yet. They're not ready for it yet. The people that need to lose the right to the land haven't quite done their part yet, and they haven't completely lost it yet, but it's going to happen, which itself can open up all kinds of theological questions. But it's the first part of that verse which is intriguing. For he says the fourth generation will come here. An ancient halachic midrash found in the Mechilta asks the obvious question. Within three verses, it went from 400 years to fourth generation. Which one is it? Will they be enslaved 400 years, or will they be enslaved for four generations. Now, all of us know a secret, and what's that? They never were slaves for 400 years. So apparently the 400 years was negotiable. The Mechilta tells us what we really have over here is a maximum and a minimum. The maximum amount of time it's going to take in order to fulfill this process will be 400 years. The minimum amount of time is four generations. So now, if you're Yaakov, what would you expect? 400 years or fourth generation? What would you like it to be? You'd like it to be four generations. Now let me tell you one other thing about this episode. In the prophecy that God says to Avraham, does he ever mention the location, the destination of this? Does he say that this will take place in the land of Egypt? Never says that. Which, by the way, this is goes into the issue of why should the Egyptians be punished? It's a prophecy. Who said that they're the ones who had to fulfill this prophecy? Who said that they're the ones who had to fulfill the way that they fulfilled it? God said at the end, I'll judge them and I'll see exactly how they did it. I mean, again, that's part of a whole issue in terms of the Egyptians and the plagues and what happens there. But over here, it never said the word Egypt. So now, can we go back to Yaakov? The one thing, as I said, that he knows, aside from what God directly says to him, his tradition, what he's walking around with, is a belief, a faith, a trust that God has spoken to his grandfather. This is what he knows. And he knows that Jewish history is going to be complex. He knows that it has within it slavery, and by the way, most likely that's the reason that Esav detests the role of the firstborn, the Yivez Esav es HaBechora. Esav detests the role of being the firstborn, because being the firstborn means that you take upon yourself the responsibility of the covenant, and part of it means to have to work. Esav is somebody who wants immediate gratification. For him, the thought that he's going to have to get inside a 400-year contract, that's a really long-term contract, even though that at the end, there's all kinds of spiritual and financial gains to come from it. That's not Esav. Esav cannot get into this. Now, if you're Yaakov, you know about this prophecy. You know about the covenant. And you start to think about your own life. You left to a land which wasn't yours. You were basically enslaved. You were abused. And you left with great wealth. You come back to the land of Israel. And then you think, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, his children. That's the fourth generation. So Yaakov's looking at the world, and he says to himself, this is it. This is the prophecy. And by the way, I'm just going to warn you, this is one of the problems of trying to look at prophecies and interpret them for yourselves. Not because you may be wrong. It's worse than that. It could be that prophecies are written with open-ended interpretation, and that God says the prophecies where there's more than one potential endgame to it. There's more than one way that the prophecy could be fulfilled at the end. And Yaakov looks at this and he says, everything that was supposed to take place has taken place. Again, when we look at this in retrospect, we'll say, you think that was slavery, you don't know what real slavery is. You think that's making, you know, coming out with great wealth, you don't know what great wealth is. And we can now go and we can correct Yaakov at every single point, and I'm going to come back again and say, how do you know he was wrong? How do you know he was wrong? Maybe Yaakov was 100% right, and that's a scary thought. Because maybe this could have been a fulfillment of that covenant. So what went wrong? So that's the second part of Rashi. Kafatz alav rogzo shel Yosef. He was jumped by the anger of Yosef. Which means the story of Yosef ended this beautiful daydream that Yaakov was having, this possibility of redemption, this possibility of the messianic age coming in his very lifetime. And if you think about it, this is now the story that's going to take us through till the end of the book of Bereishis. This last episode, we have the first episode having to do with creation and then Noach, then we have Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the Avos, and now we move into the Yosef episode. And the Yosef episode apparently is something which Yaakov never anticipated. And I can say this on many levels that he never anticipated it. I think if he would have anticipated it, there's no way he would have showed favoritism to one son. And the rabbis, by the way, say that he was wrong for displaying favoritism to one son. But that's part of the problem over here. What do you do when you have a son like Yosef? What do you do when you have a son who's so talented, who's so gifted? And we won't have class next week because of Hanukkah, but maybe in 2 weeks we'll come back to Yosef. And one of the amazing things to me over the next couple of weeks is when the brothers meet up with Yosef, and he's asking about their father, and he's asking about their brother, and then he sits them down for dinner, and he lines them up in exactly the right age order. Why in the world can't they know that it's Yosef? I know it's Yosef. So you'll say, it's not fair, I read the book. But why can't they figure out this is Yosef? Isn't that an amazing thing? At some point they should have said, this guy cares too much and he knows too much. But you know what it is? That's what hatred is. That's what sinas chinam is. Hatred is when you can't see the greatness in another person. And the brothers never saw the greatness in Yosef. They couldn't see it. They were blind to it. It's staring at them. And incidentally, everybody else who ever meets Yosef sees it immediately. Yosef is somebody that whatever situation he gets into, he immediately rises to the top. He gets the house of Potiphar, he's running the house. He gets the prison, he's running the prison. He gets to Pharaoh's house, he's running Egypt. And if you do the math, you realize he got to Pharaoh's house at 30, he dies at the age of 110, which means he ruled Egypt, which is the greatest country, the greatest civilization at that point. He ruled Egypt for 80 years. And not only did he rule it, within 5 minutes he comes up with a 14-year economic plan, averts a possible recession. Not only that, he succeeds in coming out with a further economic plan that he eventually gets control out of all the land in Egypt, and he takes it, which, by the way, may have also contributed to the anti-Semitism that took place afterwards in Egypt, where they didn't like the Jews all that much. Don't kid yourselves about that. I mean, Yosef is an unbelievably impressive individual. Now, what do you do if you're Yaakov and you have a kid like this? I'm going to spell this out clearer. What if you're Yaakov and you have messianic aspirations and you have a kid like this? You're going to see your kid. Perhaps even, excuse me? You're certainly going to try to, but I think he does more than that. You know, there's something very interesting about Yosef. The way that he dresses and he takes care of himself and so on. So if Yosef lived today, the newspapers would call him metrosexual, which is a term which is clearly not used in the Chumash. But it's also misunderstands, you'll have to look it up, but it also completely misunderstands the character. Yosef's basic self-perception is one of kingship and leadership. Yosef sees himself as king. In Jewish law, the one person who does have to take great care of himself, of his looks, of the way he presents himself, is a king. And that is most likely why the rabbis tell us that Yosef would take care of his hair, he would take care of his, because he sees himself as royalty. The coat of many colors, again, pshat, simple reading. The coat of many colors is most likely clothing of royalty. And how do I know that? I think the Ramban points this out, but later on, we find a coat of many colors mentioned one other time in Tanakh, and that's King David's children are wearing a coat of many colors. Same term, kasonis pasim, the same phrase is used, which therefore tells me that this is the clothing of royalty. So therefore, Yosef was given clothing of royalty. Yosef sees himself as being perhaps a king, and not only that, his father sees him. That's why his father gives him the coat. Now again, you can say the father made a mistake, because if you go and anoint one of your kids as the next king or the next leader, and all the other kids are around there, especially he's the youngest one, that could cause bad blood. But I'm saying it's not just the bad blood, it's that they never saw it. They were blind to it. And therefore, when they meet up with Yosef, who does become king, again, think of his incredible dreams that he has. Everyone's going to bow down to me. So was he right or wrong? Yep. Yeah, he was right. Yosef sees himself as royalty. Is he right or is he wrong? Yep. He's right about that. But who can't see it? His brothers can't see it. And that's part of the tragedy. Now, you had a question or...? Okay.
The world was made for Torah.
Maybe. Torah can be understood in many different ways. If Adam wouldn't have sinned the first day, Adam would have been Mashiach and the world would have been redeemed. Don't get excited about Torah. Look, on the other hand, they also taught you, on the other hand, that Abraham kept the whole Torah. So then he did have Torah. Okay? I mean, you can't have that both ways. But it means something else. What it means in terms of perfection, it means in terms of perfection that it would have been the Messianic age, and the Torah in a more complete sense could have been given at that point. Just like we would believe that when the Mashiach does come, Torah will be given in a more complete sense. Again, and then you can say, and you can even say that, say in retrospect, oh, now you thought Torah was given. No, then Torah was really given. So it's like, you got to get out. You have to get out of mindsets that we're stuck into sometimes.
Oh, what midot behavior did Yosef display while he was living amongst his family that led his father and himself to believe that he was destined for king for greatness? Because I might have missed it. I don't really remember.
So go back and read it again.
I'll tell you.
I can't answer your question and fill out a form and say he's got this, he's got this, he's got this. Like, I don't have a checklist. I can't do it. But what I can say, there are a couple things that are there. Ben Zakunim, for example. What does Ben Zakunim mean? So the simple reading of that is it depends what the word Zakain means. So does the word Zakain, Ben Zakunim means that he was a child when Yaakov was an old person. And that's why he loved him. The Unculus there says, not Ben Zakunim, Ben Chacham. That he was very wise. That seems to be the first thing, seems to be his brilliance. And if I follow through Yosef's life, and I look how he responds to situations, he is a long-term thinker. You would not want to play chess against Yosef. He sees moves all the way down. You also see another thing, that he does not give into momentary temptation, and he's able to put things off and to get more of a long-term perspective on things. So, but I'm saying on top of that, most likely what he has is complete brilliance.
That was evident while he was living amongst his brothers?
Yeah.
In all these other commentaries, it says that he was very immature and...
I'm not responsible for other commentaries. Okay? And not all the other commentaries say it.
Well, some of them.
Some say it, fine. And by the way, he may have had all of these capabilities, and as a father he sees, okay, the immaturity is the thing that one day he'll outgrow.
Do you think maybe he saw his potential and not what he really was at that time?
I think that's what most people do. And therefore he sees the greatness in him, and the brothers don't see it. They only see the immaturity. Again, who misreads it? I think they misread it more than he misreads it.
Right.
But again, just because, you know what? Just because you're smarter than everyone else, do you have to tell everyone else that you're smarter than them? It can get a little annoying. Yeah.
What can be gained from the fact that, what type of insight can be gained from the fact that the eventual line of royalty for the Jewish people wasn't passed through Yosef's?
You guys got to let me start. I haven't said anything yet today. Good. Let's begin then. All this was introduction. So it didn't work out the way that Yaakov wanted it to. And the brothers seem to have had a pathological hatred towards him. The hatred stems from jealousy. Yosef's name, Yosef, equals 156, which equals kin'ah, which equals jealousy. It also equals tzion, which is Zion, Jerusalem, and there's lots of midrashim which try to spell out this connection between Yosef and Zion, and between a jealousy, and therefore what happened to Yosef, what happened to Jerusalem, which is also an interesting interrelationship. Now, place all that on the side. The other thing that takes place, at least in the first chapter in this parasha, Perek Lamed Zion, is something which is so horrific that, again, you're going to start up with me and you're going to tell me that the commentaries read it differently. I told you, I'm not responsible for the commentaries. I read them and I appreciate them and we love them, but we still have to read the commentaries as commentaries, but first we need to understand the text. There are levels over here. And first, if you can't understand the text, you can't begin to understand the commentaries. Something takes place over here which is so horrific that even when we try to whitewash it and to try to sanitize it and to show why it really wasn't so bad, Yosef comes to see his brothers. Why does he come to see his brothers? Because his father sends him. And again, The rabbis tell us the father made a mistake. He says, go and see what's going on. You'll report to me. Which means Yosef, as it was telling his father what was going on, and they did not appreciate that all that much. So he sends Yosef along the way, and he says, go and see what's going on. The Torah then tells us something which seems completely irrelevant. Perek Lamed Zayin Tesvav. Yosef is on the way, but he got lost along the way. And the guy says to him, he goes, what do you want? What are you looking for? And he says, I'm looking for my brothers. And by the way, this phrase of Yosef, as far as I can tell, never changes the rest of his life. He's always looking for his brothers. His brothers are never looking for him. But he's looking for his brothers. This verse is an incredible verse. Because you know what? When you're writing a document as significant as the Torah, why include a verse within it to say, oh, and on the way to get where his father told him to go, he got a little confused and the guy pointed him in the right direction. Why? So the one hand is the second half of the verse I just now told you, his answer. I'm looking for my brothers. That's sincere. When you consider what the brothers did to him and what Yosef could have done to them, what he could have done to them, you realize that Yosef really does desire his brother's love and companionship, something which he may probably never got. I'm just pointing out that the rejection of Yosef may be far more profound than simply the rejection of an individual. The rejection of Yosef may actually be the rejection of somebody who had messianic potential. That's the underlying issue. But let's continue a little bit more. There's another level to this, and that is, can you imagine later on in Yosef's life, he's saying to himself, I cannot believe it. Had that guy not bumped into me in the field and told me to go in the right way, all of this never would have happened. Is that what Yosef believes? Later on, when his brothers do find out that it's Yosef, and they say, and what does Yosef say to them? You did not do this to me, God did this to me. Why is he saying that? On the one hand, maybe he wants to make them feel better. But this is, again, this is the depth of Yosef's thought. What does he say to them? That if God wanted me to get to Egypt, even if I was going the other direction, he was going to get me down to Egypt. And he was going the other direction. Think about it. Yosef is going from the area of Hebron, that's where he starts, and he goes north towards Shechem. And where does he end up? He ends up in Egypt. Why? Because if God wants you in Egypt, you're going to end up in Egypt. And over here, you could think that this is an accident and maybe... No. This does not exonerate the brothers for their behavior. It's just pointing out that there's a much larger issue taking place. And you realize the real irony over here. That is, the brothers thought they were eventually, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, the brothers thought they were selling Yosef as a slave. What ended up happening? They ended up selling themselves as slaves. What ended up happening? They all end up in Egypt. What ends up happening? All of their children end up being slaves. Which means sometimes when you do something to someone else, you don't realize that the person you're really destroying is yourself.
Joseph was trying to find his brothers out of respect for his father, not so much because he sincerely wanted to get in touch with his brothers.
I think the respect for his father is an incredibly important element. I don't think it's the only element. You can argue with me. Let's continue then. Yosef is seen by his brothers from afar. Before he gets there, and they start to plot to kill him. And then they see, here comes the dreamer. Let's going to be with his dreams. Let's take him. We'll kill him. We'll throw him to one of the pits and we'll say a wild beast. Not only are they ready to kill him, they're planning the killing. They're planning how they're going to do it. And they're planning the alibi. We'll say a wild animal did it. This is not a nice way to behave. Reuven hears this, and Reuven, and most likely Reuven as the oldest, realizing that he will bear the brunt of the responsibility if something goes wrong. Reuven already has one strike against him in terms of the episode with Bilhah. Reuven says, no, put him in a pit. And it's interesting, Torah tells us what he's thinking. Put him in a pit, and he's thinking, I'll save him afterwards. Reuven says, don't spill blood. Put him in the pit. And presumably the way they understand Reuven's suggestion is, don't kill him, put him in the pit. You put somebody in a pit for a long enough time, the pit will look like he fell into the pit. But Reuven, as we know his intention. When Yosef gets there, the brothers strip him of the clothing. which on the one hand takes away the element which makes him king, which makes him royal, but on the other hand, it's a complete act of humiliation, ripping the clothing off of somebody and throwing them cold and naked into the pit over there cannot be a wonderful experience. And what do the brothers do afterwards? This is one of the harshest scenes in the Torah.
They have a meal.
They sit down and they eat. V'yishvu lechol lechem. They sit down and they eat. Incidentally, I believe, and I don't believe any of the commentaries say this, but I believe that one of the reasons that we have a Passover Seder when we leave Egypt, when we sit down as a whole family, is a tikkun, is fixing this meal that they had right there on the way down to Egypt. Which means going down to Egypt, we go down as a family divided. Again, we think we're getting rid of him, but we're really all going to be going down. When we leave Egypt, we need to sit down as a family together in order to be able to leave. It's sort of the other side of this coin over here. Any of you can write this down. As far I'm telling you, it's not in any books. No one ever said it. I said it. But no, it's not in any books. See, sometimes you can say things that are not in commentaries. Anyway, they sit down and they eat and they lift up their eyes and they see a band of Yishmaelim coming. And it tells us what they have in the caravan. And Yehuda then says, and this is the first time Yehuda has a speaking role in the Torah. Yehuda then says, Ma betza, what are we going to gain? The word betza is a word that has a financial connotation to it. What are we going to gain, parenthetically, financially, from killing him? Ma betza ki naharog et achenu, what are we going to gain from killing our brother, v'kisinu et damo, and covering up the blood? By the way, what do you expect him to say next? Now, it's very cynical. What are we going to gain from killing our blood? Then he continues and he says, L'chuvanim karenu l'Yishmaelim, let's go sell him to the Yishmaelim. V'yadenu al tihibo, therefore our hands would not have spilled this blood. Why? Ki achenu b'sarenu hu, for he's our flesh and blood. He's our brother. V'yishmu echav, and his brother listened to him. You have to realize there's something sick about this. Which means I would have thought, he's our brother, therefore let's, okay, enough. We humiliated him, we made fun of him, we ripped the clothing off of him. Enough. He's our brother. No, he's our brother. Let's not kill him. Let's sell him. So over here is when there's something which is profoundly, profoundly disturbing. They take him out of the pit. They sell him. They have a slight problem now. And what's that? What are they going to tell their father? So they take the coat and they dip it in blood and they send it to their father and they say to him as follows, this we found. Hakarina, do you recognize this? Haksonis binchahi umlo, is this your son's coat or not? Now, if you want a lesson in interpreting Torah texts, the first important rule of interpreting texts is to read a verse and to determine what the tone of voice is as it's being said. Within the reading the tone of voice properly, you will understand what the words really mean. Do they say this and they're laughing as they say it? This is the funniest thing. We found this goat. Do you recognize it? No, they're not saying this laughing. How are they saying it?
Solemnly.
Solemnly. Excellent word. How they say it? They're saying it. Do they know whose coat it is? They know whose coat it is.
Fake confusion.
It's deceit. It's deception. Yeah. It's deception. It's fake emotion. It's emotion which is not really there. They're saying it, making believe that they really care, because they don't care. Because if they cared, they would not be in this situation. They have to get closure. What's the closure going to be? The closure going to be to their father, guess what? You don't have your favorite son anymore, and now you have to deal with the rest of us. But maybe we're all losers, but we're all together over here, and your favorite son is gone. Are they going to say it like that? No. So how do they say it? As I said, they make believe they care. He looks at the coat, but you cry Yaakov is simlosav. Yaakov tears his clothing. He puts on sackcloth, and he mourns him for many days. All of his children come, and they try to comfort him, and he refuses to be comforted, and he said, I will go to my grave mourning for my son. And then we end the chapter with the following verse. The Midianim took him and sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, Srisparo Sar Tabachim, which is a wonderful verse. because over here we don't even notice it. But he said, tells us where Yosef ends up. I'm going to skip the whole next chapter right now and go to chapter 39. Chapter 39 starts off the first verse, and Yosef was taken down to Egypt. He was bought by Potiphar, Sarah Tabachim. It's the same verse that chapter 37 ended with, which means we only have a slight problem, and that's all of chapter 38. Now, I don't know if you've ever read any biblical criticism or any biblical critics, but they're wonderful in the tunnel vision that they have in reading biblical texts. In this particular case, they say, look at this. Chapter 37 ends with Yosef on his way down to Egypt. Chapter 39 takes up the story literally the next day. And chapter 38 deals with something else. Those of you who don't know chapter 38, it starts to tell us the story of Yehuda. It tells us that Yehuda got married. It tells us that Yehuda had a kid. It tells us he has a second kid. It tells us he has a third kid. He tells us Yehuda's kid grew up. Yehuda's kid got married. Hold it. How many years just went by? So the biblical critics say, look at this. This must come from some other source, and some editor just threw all the information together, because chapter 38, they claim, has nothing to do with 37 or 39. It's just extraneous material which was thrown in. So I just want to tell you something. They're wrong. But not only are they wrong, see, all of us have a great advantage over Bible critics. You know what it is? Baruch Hashem, thank God, we were brought up watching television, reading movies, and even occasionally reading books. Television, movies, books, it did something for us. You know what this is called? This is called character development. You take one character, develop to a certain point. You take a second character, develop them to a certain point. Why would you do that? Because the two characters eventually are going to meet up with one another. And that's going to take place down the line. But I'm just going to play a little bit with this, and you're going to see how much chapter 38 is related. So let's continue another step. Yehuda's son grows up. His name is Er. He dies. Now, if you're Yehuda, and your son just now died, what would you think? I didn't ask you what you would do. What would you be thinking? Why did your son die? And then retribution. Again, good word. You guys are good today. Retribution. Or those of you who don't like such big words, you can say karma. Or you can say that God is coming and punishing you. That you caused your father to mourn for a son who's not really dead. How's God going to get back at you? God's going to kill your son. And now deal with that. By the way, what should Yehuda do at this point? What should Yehuda do that would make us respect him so much? Exactly. Yehuda at this point should come over to Yaakov and say, Dad, I know that you may never speak to me again. Now that I'm a father, I know what you're going through. I am embarrassed for what I've done. I have no words, but I'm going to tell you one thing. Your son Yosef was not really dead. We believe he's in Egypt, and I will go and try to find him. That's the moral response. That's what Yehuda should do. What happens instead? He tells the wife of his son, her name is Tamar, he tells his other son, his second son, you marry her. And that seems to be the custom we find later on in the Torah. It seems to be the practice at the time. The second brother takes responsibility for the widow of the first brother. He marries her, and we're told that he's killed as well by God. He also dies. So if you're Yehuda, you just lost your second son. So what do you do now? At some point, so what does it say? It says he tells Tamar, wait, because he has a third son. He goes, no, but he's too young. Wait, he'll grow up. But again, the Torah tells us what he's thinking. He has no intention of giving the third son because he's afraid he's going to die also. But this is wonderful. Projection. Who's he blaming for the death of his sons? It's Tamar's fault. It's Tamar's fault. Again, what happens when Yehuda goes to sleep at night? Does the scene of deceiving his father still come back to him? The moment that he looked in his father's eyes and he shattered his world, does that still play back? Does Yehuda have guilt? Don't have to tell me. I know. One second. Then we're told that Yehuda's wife dies. Now, him losing his wife should help us a little bit understanding, or his understanding, how Tamar feels, even though it's not parallel at all. Here's Tamar, her biological clock ticking away, waiting for a third son who's already grown up, and basically told by Yehuda, you sit and wait, it's okay, you wait. Anyway, Yehuda, after his wife dies, is lonely. We're told he travels back to where the area where Tamar lives. She hears that he's on the way. She hears that the third son had grown up. And we're told that she takes matters in her own hands, and she dresses up as a prostitute, stands on the side of the road. Her face is covered. Yehuda doesn't recognize her. Yehuda tries one of the great pickup lines. None of you try this at home. He says,
"I give you a goat."
No. The goat comes later.
I give you a goat.
No, that comes later. It says, "Vayom."
Come if you please, let me consort with you.
Come if you please, let me consort with you. No, the Hebrew's better.
Shall we consort?
Vayir'eh Yehuda ve'achsher lezona. Vayet aleha el aderech. Vayomer, he says, Havana avo elayich. Can I have relations with you? That's literally what he says. As I said, don't try this. Ki lo yada ki kala. So he doesn't know it's his daughter. Okay, then try it. Okay. She says, what are you going to give me? And he says, I'll give you one of the goats for my flock. And she says, great, but this is a cash business. So he says, what do you want as collateral? And she says, give me your coat, give me your staff, give me your ring, which means she asks for personal effects. He's with her. She quickly changes her clothing and disappears from there. Yehuda sends the goat with a friend of his. Say, if you see this woman, give her the goat. The guy says, can't find her. So it's asking around. There was no hooker over here. So Yehuda finally says, what, she's going to make a fool out of us? I'm going to put an ad in the paper. Will the hooker who was with Yehuda please step forward? So he just forgets about it and moves on. Now, I want to ask you something. If you were Tamar at this point, you probably have some anger built up. Here's a man who's basically just taken advantage of you. You have his personal effects. You can catch him doing the same thing that you did, but it's even worse on his side. But she doesn't do anything. In fact, we're told that she gets pregnant. And instead, look, today we know what she would do. She would call a press conference. She would lay out all of his personal effects. She would then have a lawyer right there ready to sue him, damages, and who knows what she would do to him. She just waits. And by the way, there's no question that Tamar is the hero of the story. She just waits. Yehuda then is told a couple months later that Tamar is pregnant. He goes, take her out and kill her. She then, who she's had his possessions the whole time, she sends him the possessions, and she says the following. She says, the person who made me pregnant, these are his possessions. Do you recognize them? And the Hebrew, by the way, works a little bit better, because what she says in the Hebrew is, Hakerna, do you recognize? Lemiha chosemis, do you recognize this? And I don't know if any of you have noticed this. Bless you. Have noticed this, but the words that she uses are the identical words that the brother used when they sent the coat to their father. And I want you to think a second. The deception that took place between the brothers and their father involved a coat, it involved a goat, and it involved these words. The deception over here involves a goat, it involves the coat, and involves the same words. The response of Yehuda over here is, Vayakir Yehuda. Yehuda recognized, but he goes one step further and he says, she's more righteous than I am. Tzadkami meni. She's more righteous than I am. If you go through the whole Torah, or certainly the book of Bereishis, there are two different Yehudas. There's the Yehuda before this episode, and there's the Yehuda after this episode. Yehuda changes. Before this episode, Yehuda seems to be self-centered, cynical, pragmatic. After this episode, Yehuda turns out to be heroic, brave, generous. It's not the same person. What happened? First of all, Tamar is the one who turns him around. Tamar is the one who helped him find his greatness. His name is Yehuda. Yehuda means what? Lahodot. Lahodot means to be thank you. Leah said thank you to God. Odeh Hashem apam. She thanks God. But the word Yehuda can also be that you're modeh. Modeh ani lefanecha. What do you mean when you say modeh ani lefanecha? Thank you. What?
Thanks, I give.
But it can also mean to admit something. When you admit something, you're modeh. You say, I admit. The Tosefta tells us that Yehuda becomes the king of Israel because of his ability to admit his mistake over here. This is the starting point of the kingship. That's the Tosefta. There's a Medrash in Bereishis Rabba that asks an unbelievable question. It says, where was Yaakov? What was Yaakov doing during the sale of Yosef? So it says Yaakov was mourning and crying. What were the brothers doing that they were involved in mourning as well? Where was Yosef? Yosef was involved in mourning, but he was taken off to Egypt. Where was Yehuda? He was busy getting a wife. And then the Medrash asks that unbelievable question that we would all love to ask. What is it? Where was God during the sale of Yosef? And the Medrash says that God was busy, Osek, Bore, Oro, Shomelech HaMashiach, that God was creating the light of the Messiah. The light of the Messiah was created at this moment. Now, I've already, I think, showed you why chapter 38 is absolutely related thematically. See, the problem with Bible critics is they look at things historically. The Torah is not just a history book. It doesn't have to tell us all the events in the exact sequence. The Torah is a book of theology. Thematically, chapter 38 is absolutely connected to chapter 37 and much better, or much deeper, let's say, it's more related than most chapters of the Torah. Again, in terms of the themes, the elements. But the Medrash is saying, why is chapter 38 there? Because God was busy creating the light of Mashiach, which means before the Jews are going to go into what will turn out to be the first exile into Egypt, God is creating that light that will help redeem them at the end of the exile, the very end of days. Namely, Mashiach ben David, the line of David which comes from Judah. Ultimately, in Judaism, we have two different lines of Mashiach. There's a line of Mashiach that comes from Yosef, known as Mashiach, the son of Yosef, and there's a line of Mashiach that comes from Yehuda, and that's known as Mashiach ben David. Ultimately, they need to work together. Ultimately, Yehuda needs to appreciate Yosef, and Yosef needs to appreciate Yehuda. And if you take these two and you put them together, then you really unleash the power of the Jewish people. The problem is in Bereishis, they never work together. In Bereishis, they're at odds at one another. And one of the problems that the brothers never realize about Yosef, what do they see about Yosef? That he wants to be king. Maybe they already know, maybe they don't know that Yehuda will be king. So how can Yosef be king? And therefore the rabbis tell us, see, we always get back to the commentaries afterwards. The rabbis therefore tell us that they put Yosef on trial because he rejects the kingship of Yehuda. But you know what they never realize? Yosef is great and unbelievably great, but Yosef is never in charge. Every place Yosef goes, he's always second in charge. He's the one who helps his father. He's the one who helps Potiphar. He's the one who helps the person in the prison. He's the one who helps Paro. He's never in charge. Which means if you have a guy like Yosef who could have helped Yehuda and the two of them come together, that brings about redemption. That brings about salvation. This chapter over here is the chapter about the birth of Mashiach. The birth of Mashiach comes from Yehuda and his daughter-in-law. And I want you to appreciate this. This is something that Christianity, listen, we're getting close to Christmas, I have to explain this. This is something which Christianity never understood. They go and they create a myth of a virgin birth because they're so embarrassed. How can it be that the mother of Mashiach would have had relations? Well, guess what? Everybody has relations. Guess what else? When you trace the lineage of Mashiach, you find on one side, it goes up to David, and David had his own sordid affairs. You go up a little further, you get to Yehuda, who is with his daughter-in-law. You go on the other side from Rus, you go all the way up to Moab, which is the result of Lot sleeping with his daughter, and you realize that it is only from the mistakes that we end up finding greatness. Yehuda is the first Baal Tshuva. And I know that 3/4 of the people in the room now think that they're Baal Tshuva. You're not Baal Tshuva. Leave me alone. The word Baal Tshuva is appropriate to somebody who was profoundly bad and then becomes good. And that's Yehuda. Yehuda is the first Baal Tshuva. Most people that call themselves Baal Tshuva today, people who weren't educated, become more educated. You need to come up with a new term. If you want, I'll give you suggestions. Call yourselves Nouveau Froom. Right? It'll work much better. And it sounds more exotic. You're not Baal Tshuva, you're Nouveau Froom. The Yehuda becomes a Baal Tshuva when he recognizes the profound mistakes that he made. He recognized it. He played with one person's life. He played with another person's life. He didn't care about his children's death, again, in really a deep religious way. And all of this changes because Tamar teaches him this. But what's our message? What's our lesson? What do we learn from this? God uses broken vessels. In Judaism, there's nothing as whole as a broken heart. God takes broken vessels and he uses broken vessels to complete his mission. And that's something that we need to recognize. Because we can look at a world which is imperfect. We can look at a world which has all kinds of problems and all kinds of mistakes in it, and we can say, that's it, nothing good can come of this. You know, there's a remarkable document that was written in the middle of the Holocaust. It was written by a rabbi, Rabbi Techtel. Rabbi Techtel was brought up as a Satmar Chassid. I don't know if any of you appreciate what that means. He was brought up to believe that the most evil thing in the world were the Zionists. And his Rebbe taught him the Zionists are terrible. Why? They're not religious. And therefore, anything that they're doing cannot result in anything good. In the middle of the Holocaust, he wrote a book called Eim HaBanim Smecha, which is in English and in Hebrew. You can find it. And in it, he points out some of the things I pointed out about Yehuda. And he says, what was my Rebbe talking about? Zionism, which could be built from the worst people, nonetheless, God's wish can be accomplished by all kinds of broken vessels. Broken vessels, far away, full of mistakes. When God wants something to happen, it's going to happen. And you don't reject something because the wrong person is doing this. But there's also a profound issue in terms of Mashiach. Christianity decided to create a Messiah who never made a mistake. And if you think about it a bit, if that's the case, who should have been Mashiach? That should have been Yosef. Yosef is the one who stares at temptation, Mrs. Potiphar, Mrs. Robinson, whatever you want to call her, and he looks at her and he's able to turn around and walk away. That took unbelievable strength. A 17-year-old who's in prison, who's enslaved, and he can have favors with the woman of the house, that's not a bad position to be in. But Yosef walks away from this. Yehuda, on the other hand, sins. But it's from the sin of Yehuda that we eventually have redemption taking place. Because Mashiach is going to teach the world how all of us have made mistakes. And Mashiach is going to take all of those broken vessels which exist and do the most important gesture, and that's turn around. When you're walking and you're marching the wrong direction, at some point you need to stop and to turn around. That's what Yehuda does. Those are the words, Tzad Kamimeni. She is more right just than I am. That is the power of Mashiach being created. And one day, we hope it will come soon, where the descendant of Yehuda and of David will come, merge together with the descendant of Yosef, and bring about the Messianic age, and teach the world, take all these broken vessels, and teach the world how all the mistakes that we made could be utilized in our service of God. And we hope that we live to see that day. Have a good Shabbos.
Rabbi.